120, 93, and 94, which are the first three cases, and the first case is going to be 120, People versus Patel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm John Castellano for the People. I'd like to reserve 1 minute of rebuttal time.
1 minute. You have it, counsel. Go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court. The appellate division in this case contravened the criminal procedure law and well-established precedent from this court when it provided to the defendant an extra statutory remedy, even though the defendant got full merits review of his claim under a statutory remedy, and even though the statute specifically precluded...
Is there any remedy here, counsel?
Is there a remedy for a defendant after the 1 year and 30-day period? There's no remedy in coram nobis.
Why is there no remedy in coram nobis?
Because for a defendant...
Because of the statute,
Because of the statute, because of the strict jurisdictional 1 year and 30-day time period, which this court has said cannot be modified or extended by the courts except in the most exceptional circumstances.
What's the exceptional circumstance, and why isn't this one of those exceptional circumstances?
The exceptional circumstance in Seiville was that there was no other recourse available. And the reason there was no other recourse available was because the defendants in those cases neither knew nor could have known nor could have discovered that their attorneys had failed to file a notice of appeal.
Suppose the defendant in Seiville had found out at the last possible moment and had scrambled and got together a totally inadequate motion, and the motion had been rejected. Would that have barred his claim?
That if he had found out within the 1 year and 30-day period and was unable to make the motion at that time?
He made a pro se motion, but it just wasn't. It was pro se. He had no lawyer. It was a bad motion. It was denied.
He would have a different form of relief. Once the 1 year and 30, I guess you could look into the equities of the situation as to how late he actually found out, if it was the day before or 2 days before. But in any event, the 1 year and 30-day period, if the defendant had failed to make the motion within that period,
I understand what you're saying, but are you really saying that if he succeeds in getting something on paper and putting it in, he's penalized for that? That he's better off doing nothing if he finds out at the last moment?
He's certainly not better off doing nothing, because the defense makes this argument in the case, a non-diligent defendant, a defendant who waits more than 1 year and 30-day period, is not going to get any relief under Seiville.
But if, I think what Mr. What Judge Smith is suggesting is if it's... was an example of, here it is, it's 6 o'clock at night on the last day, and he says, oh, my God, you know, he writes a thing and said, I didn't get an appeal and I need help, and he puts it in an envelope and mails it to the appellate division. And it's timely on because it's mailed. And is that a bad thing? I mean, has he now really hurt himself because he had a Seiville claim the following day, but he doesn't have it now?
I guess the question is, did he have an adequate opportunity to raise the issue? And maybe if he found out the day before and he only had a day to raise that issue, it wouldn't be an adequate opportunity.
I thought your position in part was that if he files within time, and it's perhaps not the most artful presentation of his argument, he might be able to present a better argument, not in a coram nobis, because that's the second bite at the apple, but through reconsideration or re-argument. That might give him more time to perhaps present something that is of greater substance.
Absolutely. He could make a motion for reconsideration, like the defendant did in this case.
How much more time does that buy him?
That buys him, I guess, until the... within 30 days of the order issued by the appellate division.
What's your primary objection to extending Seiville to this situation? That you feel it's a second bite of the apple? Is that what's troubling you?
It's a second bite at the apple, and it also undermines, I guess, all the interests in finality. It undermines the ability of the people to retry the case should it become necessary, because there's no limit in the on coram nobis. It could be 2 years, 4 years, or 4.5 years is here, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the line. And it could be as many petitions as he wants to file. Part of the issue is the ability of the people to retry the case 5 or 10 or 15 years down the line. There's also the ability...
What's the purpose of the statute?
I think the purpose of the statute is at least fourfold. Part of that is the ability to making sure that these claims are addressed in a timely manner. That's implicated here as well, because the defendants often make new allegations in subsequent petitions. So a defendant who initially may complain about prison authorities not filing his notice of appeal may complain about the attorney later on. So those claims are distinct, and the ability to answer those claims is definitely an issue.
You suggested earlier that the defendant could make a motion to reconsider the denial of his 460-30?
Absolutely.
And he could make it even after the year's up?
I believe he can, because it's a motion for reconsideration, as long as
and
it's
why,
within
and
the time.
And why can't so if he labeled the motion he now makes motion for reconsideration, we should affirm?
Well, I believe it would have to be done in the period for reconsideration or reargument in the appellate division. That would be a 30-day period from the date of, I guess, notice of entry of the order.
So I thought I understood your argument that he did make that motion, and that was similarly denied.
That was denied. That was
so
denied.
So he's already had every opportunity he could have under the statute. So I thought that was your position.
He had the opportunity under the statute to, number one, make the motion in the first place because he had the knowledge that was necessary for it. Number two, make the motion for reconsideration. And I guess in the example, he could make that motion for reconsideration within 30 days of the denial if that denial occurred outside the period of time, 30 days of the notice of entry. I'd like to say
but in the motion for reconsideration, doesn't he have to show the court that it overlooked something that was in his previous motion? You're not allowed to bring in new matter, are you?
That's correct, Your Honor. He has to, if it's a, motion to renew.
So if you didn't have an adequate opportunity to make to get stuff in the first time, what good is a motion for reconsideration?
It could, I guess, either be a motion to renew or a motion for reconsideration. If there were facts that he knew of previously that he didn't raise in his petition, then he might be barred.
Okay, counsel. Yes. You'll have your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let's have your adversary. Let's hear from your adversary.
Thank you. Lynn Fay, representing Mr. Patel.
What do you think the purpose of the statute is? Because the legislature set this time period. They didn't set 2, 3, 4, or 5 years.
Right. Well, I think the presumption was that people would find, if there were a problem, people would find out within the year, so it gave them that year grace period. I think the main thing the statute meant to do was replace the cumbersome process of Montgomery resentencings, which is what preceded the statute. And I think it set the 1 year limit.
What's the purpose of the 1 year 30-day limitation?
Well, Your Honor, I think that was supposed to be the outside limit because they thought that people would find out within that year and gave them the 1 year to do it.
Was finality a consideration?
I'm sure finality was a consideration. But as this court held in Seiville, the 1 year period in the statute doesn't provide a cure-all for all problems.
How narrowly do we view Seiville? What do you think the premise of that is, and does it go beyond this not finding out within the 1 year?
Your Honor, I think it does. I think it applies if someone has been deprived of their right to appeal through ineffective assistance of counsel, and they have no other remedy. And Mr. Patel, at the time he filed his quorum petition, had no other remedy because he had used
You would acknowledge, though, that the appellate division can't extend the 1 year 30 days unless there's been a deprivation of due process or the right to counsel.
Right to counsel.
So the appellate division had to do what it did here, had to find a constitutional violation.
I think it had to find a constitutional violation, but here.
It can't just say, oh, let's give the guy, he looks like a good guy, give him another chance.
No, Your Honor. But I think probably we all have assumed that if someone made a motion, and I make these motions for clients all the time, because someone files a notice of appeal as to case one but not as to case two when they're concurrent sentences, I make motions all the time for to file a late notice of appeal for a client. Those, it's a minimal showing. They're routinely granted. The situation we have in this case is very rare.
After the year is up, they're routinely granted?
No. During the year, they are very routinely granted. Here, what you have, you know, the people keep saying he had a full merits review. Well, it wasn't a full merits review. It was a pro se, complete novice in the criminal justice system, floundering around while the people brought every argument to bear.
Is this a rare situation?
I think it's a rare situation because I think it's very rare that a motion made within the year is not granted, at least in the second department. My experience, I've made dozens of these motions over the years. I don't recall I've ever had any that weren't granted.
If the appellate division had denied the quorum, could he have then polished it up some more and filed another quorum on the same ground?
Well, you can file successive quorums. That's D'Alessandro and Turner and whole raft of cases.
How would that further the interest in finality and the concern about the stale evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I think going on forever does not further the interest of finality. On the other hand, I would say that someone is entitled to at least one review of the merits of an issue with counsel.
That's your limiting principle? That's your limiting principle? Everybody's entitled to at least one review?
He should have at least one review with counsel to help him. So it's not a pro
counsel
se.
To help him. Okay. With,
right. So it's not a pro se defendant flailing around against the people.
Is that the rule, counselor, you'd like us to articulate?
Well, I would say certainly at the very least that Seibel should extend to provide relief.
Where's the limit? If we grant this, I mean, where he had filed an appeal waiver and then files this motion saying I told my lawyer to file a notice of appeal and he didn't, so let me. Where do we stop? I mean, why had the year and 30? Why not just simply say you can appeal at any time until your sentence is complete?
Well, Your Honor, I think if he make, I mean, he obviously has to show some sort of diligence.
Why?
He can't just sit back. Well, Seibel says, recognizes, I think, that there's a need for diligence. You can't just sit back and twiddle your thumbs for years and years and
years.
Well,
this guy waited 3 years from the time that his motion for reconsideration was denied until he brought his writ.
Well, Your Honor, in the Second Department, they did not recognize quorum as available in this situation until Seibel was decided.
I understand that, but you're saying, you know, you can't just go on and on and on. Well, what was he doing for the last 3 years that he didn't immediately upon having been denied reconsideration bring something?
He did. He sought leave to appeal to this court. He filed a 440-10. He filed a 440-20. Well, he sought leave from when they were denied. He sought cert. And finally, when Seibel was decided, he had a new remedy available to him, unavailable before in the Second Department, and then he brought the quorum.
In a situation like this one where the pro se defendant does make an application before the year is up, could he ask for additional time instead of just making an application? Could he say, well, I just found out about this and I'd like to get counsel, but I want to make this application timely?
I imagine he could make that request. Whether it would be honored or not, I don't know. Mr. Patel, I would note, not only made the motion under 460-30, but also moved for counsel and in form of pauperous relief at the same time. People opposed both. When he moved for argument, he also again moved for in form of pauperous relief and counsel to be assigned to him. He attached the appellate division's order assigning him counsel in the Nassau case, so they clearly had already found him indigent. The people still opposed his motions, including the motion for counsel. In fact, they said, even if you grant him a late notice of appeal, you should deny his motion for counsel and for informal pauperous relief.
Counsel, does a valid waiver of the right to appeal have any meaning in these situations?
Well, Your Honor, this waiver was not valid. Second Department, the appellate division
from this case, I'm just asking generally.
If there were a valid right to appeal, it would foreclose
a valid
waiver of the right to appeal. It would foreclose consideration on appeal of some issues. It would not foreclose the appeal itself. And there might well be issues in a case, as I think there are here.
It would be a consideration.
It might be a consideration.
Even if a quorum was valid, it would still be a consideration.
It might still be a consideration. Of
course, when you have a situation like this, where you have a guilty plea, an appeal waiver, concurrent time, and a guy who apparently is not indigent and is paying his lawyer and might not want to throw his money away, is it really ineffective assistance not to file a notice of appeal in the case where he got the lesser concurrent time?
Well, Your Honor, they filed a notice of appeal in the Nassau case, and at sentencing
Nassau, he got a lot more time in Nassau.
He got more time in Nassau, but he was appealing the Nassau case. If he had been successful on that appeal, he would have been stuck with the Queens conviction. Two felonies, 8 years in prison, SORA registration for life. This was not a nothing of a case. This was not a little misdemeanor and time served. This was a significant case for him. And there was no point in appeal. If you got concurrent time in two cases, why in the world would you file a notice of appeal as to one and not the other?
Because you waived it.
But, Your Honor, this was not a valid waiver of the right to appeal.
Okay.
The appellate division has repeatedly held precisely this waiver by this judge invalid.
Okay, counsel. Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd just like to say that I think the problem is that there is no end to the repetitive applications that could be made under quorum nobis, that there is no time limit, that it could be 5 years or 10 years or 15 years down the line.
I see your point, but don't we have to assume that the appellate division granted this application? Don't we have to assume that they found ineffective assistance?
I believe the basis for the appellate division determination really is more Seibel and more what it took from Seibel.
Seibel's an ineffective assistance case, isn't it?
It is. But I think what the appellate division took from Seibel is that this court would liberally grant or give to defendants the opportunity, multiple opportunities,
They didn't say all this. They didn't say anything, as I remember.
They didn't say much at all.
Don't we have to take this at this point? We have to resolve all the inferences in the defendant's favor. And if you can see ineffective assistance or the possibility of finding ineffective assistance on this waiver, we have to affirm on this record. We have to affirm, don't we?
There were absolutely no merits to this. Well, there are two answers to that. The first one is that no review should be available because Seibel itself says that only when no other recourse is available can quorum nobis be invoked.
But isn't it easy to read Seibel to say you're entitled to one appeal?
It says that you can only invoke quorum nobis when there was no other remedy available to you. And there's good reason for that, because the interest in finality...
I was going behind that. In other words, I'm suggesting that the appellate division could have looked at this and said, you know, they've sort of said every conviction ought to be reviewed at least once, and this one wasn't, and so we're going to grant quorum and see if it should have been.
That would leave open the possibility of endless repetitive
motions.
What the legislature did in this case was to try to avoid the situation I believe that the court was in maybe just a couple of months ago, where you have 19 and 20 and 22-year-old appeals. Instead, what it said was, you know, we're going to impose a time limit, a one-year and 30-day time limit. And this court has said where that doesn't work, where the remedy is inadequate because the defendant didn't know the circumstances that were necessary to make the motion, then it could bring it. But otherwise not.
Okay.
And it very clearly states the basis.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. Appreciate it. People versus Andrews.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Lisa Napoli of Appellate Advocates for Churchill Andrews. I have 7 minutes this afternoon. I'd like to reserve 1 minute.
You've got it. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Mr. Andrews was denied his right to counsel. At the point where he was deciding whether to appeal or not, he wasn't given that option. He wasn't able to make a knowing decision about the options
because of a Padilla violation, right?
No, not because of a Padilla violation at all. Because counsel had the obligation to tell him about the advantages and disadvantages of appealing his conviction, and that she did not do.
Well, the main disadvantage she didn't tell him about was that he was removable under the immigration laws.
That's one of the advantages. That's one of the consequences. But the advantage and disadvantage.
I mean, if you assume this guy was a citizen and had no immigration problem, how was counsel's advice deficient?
Well, what the consequence of appealing the conviction would mean for him?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it would mean possibly another that he wouldn't have ended up with a felony conviction.
But she didn't tell him not to appeal. He said, "I want this thing over with, and I don't want to appeal."
What she did is she said, "Do you want to appeal?" And he said. She didn't say what it would mean to appeal or not to appeal. And he said, I just wanted to end. And instead of her explaining...
So is your argument that she must inform him of his right to appeal in a way that's more meaningful than what she did here, regardless of the grounds for any potential appeal?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The right to counsel in this state does not mean that you have somebody standing next to you with a law degree reciting a rote catechism. What you are entitled to, particularly at a point like this, where it was the right to appeal is the defendant's decision to make, not counsel's. So the defendant...
Well, he doesn't say that, though, at any point, does he? He doesn't say that the trial counsel failed to discuss with him his right to appeal? Or the
defense counsel says that.
Defendant doesn't say that, though. He doesn't put anything in the record.
We don't need him to say that, because the defense attorney admits that she didn't give him that advice. The defense attorney says that all she said to him was, do you want to appeal? And when he told her what he wanted, which is that he wanted the case to end, she just said nothing more. Instead,
if we go your way, what happens as a practical matter? Doesn't anybody who tells his lawyer, I don't want to appeal, forget about it, and then changes his mind a year later can do it?
No, what you would be enacting here is a robust right to counsel, which is, in fact, what exists in New York State.
Wouldn't one of the consequences of that robust right to counsel be that the one-year limitation would pretty much go by the boards?
No, not at all. What would have happened in this case is that counsel would have said to her client, this is what it would mean to appeal your conviction.
When would that have happened? In
at the time that he was sentenced.
Oh, the exact date. Didn't he move to withdraw his plea at one time?
That's right. He did. He wanted to withdraw his plea.
And he had a new lawyer at that time.
Right.
Now, are we talking about before when he was given the option of having the case dismissed if he went into drug treatment and successfully completed it?
Well, what she...
Do you want to appeal that?
I'm not sure what your question is.
Well, there's just so many dates here, you know, where he pleads to a situation where if he just does the drug treatment, you know, the case is dismissed. And apparently he falls off the wagon on that stuff. And all of a sudden he's back with new counsel. He wants to withdraw his plea. He fails to show. A new attorney requests another date for sentencing. And this thing goes on and on and on. And I'm just wondering where his process that he was due didn't occur, because there are more dates in here as to when he was given drug treatment opportunities and things like that. And he finally gets sentenced to 6 months, and he's released the same day.
This is not an unusual progression in Brooklyn Treatment Court. And in fact,
I certainly understand that.
Yeah,
but what you're doing is you're standing here now, this all happened in 08.
That's right.
And saying, you can't believe what a due process violation occurred here, and therefore we want 46030 to be essentially abrogated, and we want Seiville to be expanded to say that if a situation like this occurs, all bets are off. We're going to appeal, and we're going back to the 6 years ago when he was first arrested on this, so we can try the case. I don't know how we can.
This is squarely within Seiville. Seiville is the 46030 is not an inflexible bar. It is available.
What's the rule, counsel? What's in your view?
The rule is exactly what Seiville says.
Yes, tell us.
Is that if within the 46030 period, counsel, the defendant is unaware that he has the right to appeal or could not reasonably discover it during that period, then he can prevail under Seiville. And that is exactly
what
happened
here. What happened to the 440 here, though? Supreme Court denied the 440.
That's right.
Then what happened? He didn't pursue it with the appellate division?
No, the denial of the 440 was appealed.
What happened?
And that was
But then he filed a quorum.
That's right.
Didn't he, instead of pursuing the 440?
No, the 440 was continuing. I'm sorry that's unclear. The 440 was continuing. But Chaydez
held in abeyance? Is that what happened?
Chaydez was decided. You know, the 440 and the 440 appeal, the legal landscape looked very different until Chaydez was decided. And once Chaydez was decided,
you're familiar with the Barrett case that is coming up later
this week.
If the appellant should prevail in that case, what happens to your guy?
It depends on exactly how your decision is decided, but we would move to... for leave to appeal. Leave to appeal was denied in that case. I asked for a reconsideration when that application is still pending.
Barrett goes the way you want it to, you will seek reconsideration.
Maybe
we'll see you again in this case.
That's right.
Okay.
Maybe you will.
Okay, Kath. Thank you.
Okay, you'll have
your rebuttal. Counselor?
May it please the Court, Assistant District Attorney Joyce Levin for the respondent. The defendant received effective representation on appeal, and the quorum nobis was properly denied.
What's the significance of the deportation issue here?
The significance is that the defendant claims that he wasn't informed about the advantages and the disadvantages of appealing. But the determinative factor that the defendant says he wasn't informed about was deportation. And the determinative factor as to why he would have wanted to appeal is to is his last line of defense against deportation. So because Padilla rules that an attorney at this point in time did not have a duty to inform about deportation, then this defendant cannot benefit from the rule of Padilla. So actually deportation...
Well, I guess that may depend on what we decide later on, might it not?
As far as that seems a long process, whatever this court decides in Barrett, which may or may not be preserved in Barrett. As I understand, I read the leave application.
I thought your opponent was also arguing, I thought the defendant was also arguing that regardless of whatever grounds for the appeal, that he's claiming his attorney failed to properly inform him about the possibility of appealing, the opportunity of appealing, how to pursue an appeal, that he had a right to an appeal,
well,
regardless of taking the plea. And I thought that was the argument, that regardless of the grounds, that the defendant failed to properly inform and notify the defendant.
Well, two things. I think, first of all, you really cannot consider the deportation issue. It's just really out of the box. So then we're left, if your attorney didn't have a duty to talk about deportation, what was the attorney's duty? Which is controlled by Roe versus Flores-Ortega and these courts' decisions and this court's decision in Lynn
but
versus
again, Trump. Perhaps I'm not being clear. I thought your adversary's argument was, regardless of the ground, because that is one ground, there may be other grounds. Who knows? Right?
Grounds for
there may be other grounds. And so I thought the argument was, and perhaps I've misunderstood the argument, I'll ask her when she comes back up on rebuttal, that the lawyer had to explain that regardless of taking the plea, there was still an opportunity to appeal and why that might be advantageous besides the most obvious reasons.
Well,
are you saying that that the lawyer had no such duty and obligation?
I'm saying that an attorney's duty is a case-by-case basis. And when there's a guilty plea, there is far less of a duty because there's a presumption on a guilty plea that the defendant has no reason or desire to appeal. And if you take deportation out of this picture, then the defendant hasn't shown that he wanted to undo this plea. He got out of jail the day of sentence. He would have been put back to his pre-plea status.
So when someone takes a plea, what's the lawyer's duty and obligation with respect to informing them about their right and opportunity to appeal?
It depends. It depends on the case. It depends on whether
what would be the minimum? What's the minimum?
It depends on the case. I mean, if a defendant is unaware whatsoever that there's even an appeal, mm-hmm. he would probably have some kind of recourse down the line. And if you're looking at the better practice, I mean, certainly the better practice is to go on about the appeal. But if you're looking for, is this attorney deficient? Was this defendant denied effective assistance? That's a different test.
Well, Ms. Levin, I'm curious because there's an appeal waiver here, right? He signed it away.
Yes, he did.
Waiver. If that's no good, if the appeal waiver is no good, I worry about pleas being offered. It's usually the DA who says, you know, we'll give you this plea. In this case, it was drug rehabilitation and a dismissal. If there's no appeal waiver, and if we're going to collaterally attack every one of these appeal waivers and say they're no longer valid, I worry that we're going to infect the plea procedure by saying there is no such thing as a valid plea appeal waiver.
So I'm sorry, what's your question?
Well, I was throwing you a softball. What I was saying is...
You're
supposed to agree with him, I guess.
It seems odd that I would throw you a softball.
Yes, it would. I mean, if the waiver of the right to appeal is to have any meaning to it, then the defendant would have to file a timely appeal. We'd have to show, he still has to show that he would have wanted to appeal. And once you plead guilty, especially in a case like this, why would the defendant want to appeal? He shows absolutely no reason why he would have wanted to appeal, except we're going back to deportation, and it's circular. And the reason why this is circular is because the right to be advised about deportation occurs at a guilty plea. And this happened at the time of the sentence regarding an appeal.
Now, he appealed to 440, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And last I knew, it was still pending. Do you know what happened to him?
The 440 was denied, and then he sought leave before this court, and that was denied. So he actually had two leave applications before this court. The denial of the 440, this court did not grant leave, and we're here now in this case.
Counsel, your adversary said this is Seibel. Is this Seibel, or is this another request for an extension or another sort of exception?
Well, first of all, it's very different from Seibel because there's a plea, so the standard is very different. It's also different from Seibel in a very important way. Well, in Seibel, there were trials, and the attorneys told the defendants, don't worry, I'm going to file a notice of appeal. So there's a detrimental reliance, which this defendant didn't have here. So I think here the focus is more on what was the duty of the attorney to talk to the defendant upon a guilty plea, and did the defendant show any indication that he wanted to appeal, whether non-frivolous claims to be raised on appeal. So it's almost not even in the Seibel universe, so it would be quite an extension of Seibel under the facts of this case.
Okay, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel Rebell?
I think we're all getting really sidetracked by the immigration
How
issue.
So?
Because it doesn't the Mr. Andrews immigration situation is a specific fact about him, but that doesn't change the defense attorney's duty. The defense attorney's duty is to explain the advantages and disadvantages of appealing. And Mr.
So
Andrews,
where do you think Seibel ends? In the earlier one, it sounded like the argument is that you got to get one appeal. Whether you waived it or not, you're entitled to one appeal, or at least some attempt to get that one appeal up. Is this one the same? I mean, is this because he never had one appeal?
He never had one appeal, and this case shows how important that is, and it shows how easy it is to fall in between the cracks in that transition phase when, as you move from trial, or plea in this case, to the appellate
phase. But this one is 3 years later, right? I think he took the plea in 08, and now here in 11, he's trying to do this.
That's right.
At some point, you wonder where the complainants are, where the witnesses are, where, I mean, it'd be very easy to say, you know, you weren't granted an appeal, so you know what, we're going to vacate your plea, and we're going to send everybody back to square one. We find out there's nobody standing there.
And this is a case where the fact that it's a plea works in his favor,
yeah.
Isn't it? Because there are no witnesses. What we have here is Brooklyn Treatment Court. It is really important to recognize that this was an offense that nobody thought, not the people, not the court, thought was worth prison time or jail time. They didn't even think.
That's why I asked your opponent. You know, this keeps up. I mean, why go get an appeal waiver? Why not say, let's try this thing? I mean, I'm guessing they probably had him pretty cold because he wanted to plead guilty. And so, you know, now you can do your time and we don't have to worry about all of this and you can appeal all you want.
This is not about skating past the waiver of
you're
the right to appeal.
You're attacking Brooklyn Treatment Court.
Or skating past deadlines.
You're attacking the Brooklyn Treatment Court, saying this is a problem that they have with the Brooklyn Treatment
no,
Court.
No, I didn't say that. You were upset about the chain of events, and I simply
yes.
said that's not unusual.
You're saying this is part of the course
in
the Brooklyn Treatment Court.
There's nothing bad about Brooklyn Treatment Court, but it's a court in which we've decided we are not going to punish the people going
so
to this court.
So you give people chances
exactly.
and chances and chances.
But how many chances do you get before 3 years have expired? Now you say, I want to vacate my plea, and by the way, the officer's retired, nobody can find the drugs, and I guess I get out of here.
We're not at the point where that is happening. What we had here is a man who pled guilty in a case where everyone disagreed that punishment wasn't what was warranted here. Not prison time, not jail time.
All right, let's assume all that's true. What's going to happen now?
What the courts and the people agreed was what this was worth was drug treatment, help. Not punishment.
But let's assume you're right. Let's assume you get your appeal and they affirm it. Now, what have we accomplished? Let's assume you get your appeal and it gets reversed. Now, what have you accomplished?
In Mr. Andrews' case, his overriding concerns were getting drug treatment and avoiding removal. Right.
That's well. You
so
said,
at this point he.
You said immigration is screwing this up. And,
no, no,
and
no.
We shouldn't
I
be talking about that. Well, the whole point is that until ICE came around, that's when all of a sudden lights went on and he's moving to vacate.
No, that's not true. No lights went on because he didn't know anything. He pled guilty with the goal of getting drug treatment, right?
Right.
And
it would have been dismissed.
And that. But even if it had been dismissed, that would have been he would have still been mandatorily and permanently removable. Even if the case was dismissed, the fact of his plea alone rendered him permanently and mandatorily removable. Right?
Right.
So it didn't matter if he failed or succeeded at drug treatment.
But he got sentenced on the 3rd. ICE came after him on the 4th. And he files the 440 on the 24th.
That's right. Through counsel, he files a 440.
But you're making it sound like that ICE part doesn't even have to be in there.
No, but the ICE, I feel like we're collapsing two issues together. We're talking about what counsel's duty is. Counsel's duty when it comes to deciding whether to appeal for a conviction or not, that is the defendant's decision to make.
But wasn't that in 08?
Yes, and counsel's duty at that time was to explain to him the advantages and disadvantages of doing
and
so.
And having signed a waiver.
Right.
Having had a year and 30 days to appeal.
That's right. And And that waiver, as we, you know, this is not a questionable waiver. It is a plainly invalid waiver. And in order for waivers of appeal, in order for the plea, for a plea to work, a system that relies in great part on pleas to work, we have to respect a waiver. And waivers have to be knowing and voluntary choices. So we can't skate past those times.
Okay, Kath.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Judge Rivera,
Judge,
go ahead.
I ask one question?
Sure.
Very briefly, obviously, because your time is up. Is there anything that was said during the colloquy, either the plea or sentencing, either way, that somehow would have misled him regarding to his right to appeal?
Absolutely.
What would that be?
Well, he was a layman. It's his first offense. He's at 43. This is his first offense. And when he when at his plea, he waives his right to appeal. Now, it is an invalid waiver, and there's no colloquy on the record. So it is a legally invalid waiver. But in a layman's eyes, he would have thought, well, I waived my right to appeal. And then when he's sentenced, the court says, incorrectly, you waived your right to appeal. And counsel didn't correct that. So he was uninformed and misled.
Okay. Thanks, counsel.
Thank you.
Kruger?
Good afternoon. I'm Benjamin Ostrer on behalf of appellant Kevin Kruger.
You want any rebuttal time out of your 3 minutes? Okay. Take your three. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's no dispute that there was ineffective assistance with respect to Mr. Kruger's representation.
I was struck by the fact that you seem to be arguing that it's the appellate division that decides whether or not something is timely filed with us.
Well, no, Your Honor. What we're stating is that within the compass of the right to appeal to the appellate division is a right to file a leave application to this court. We sought to enlarge that time to file a late leave application to this court. That is something that a defendant appellant can do as of right.
I just wasn't, I guess I'm being educated. I thought you would make that application to this court and not to the appellate division.
Well, the way we read it, we needed to make it to the appellate division through quorum nobis.
So, I mean, you're saying that the appellate division can say, you know, you only got X number of days to go to the Court of Appeals. We're going to give you an extra 30. And we're bound by that?
Well, if I can file my – apparently so. If I was mistaken, then I've advised Mr. Kruger incorrectly. But I believe that what we were compelled to do was to seek – relief from the appellate division to file a late claim and to enlarge our time to file with the Court of Appeals.
You say that the lawyer was ineffective, but
well, it's me,
do you
Your
have
Honor.
A right to effective assistance at this point?
You're pro se today.
Well, I am. I'm
Go ahead. Answer him first.
No, I'm sorry, Judge. I didn't. I'm sorry.
Do you have a right to effective assistance at the second appeal stage?
Well, it's not the second appeal. It's the leave application for that appeal. And that is a matter of right that a defendant or appellant in the appellate division.
By statute, it's a matter of right. But
right.
Do you have a constitutional right to effective assistance at that stage?
Well, I believe due process applies to any advice from counsel on anything the appellant is doing as a matter of right. Seivel states that we, as a matter of constitutional concern, is the advice that somebody gets with respect to his appeal as of right to the appellate division. Well, the leave application is a matter of right to that same person, and he should be.
Anything that the state gives you a statutory right to do, it also has to provide counsel for you to do it?
Not necessarily, but that doesn't mean that you should be compromised by incorrect advice from your counsel.
I take it what you're saying is that even if you don't have this right, if indeed the attorney, if the reliance is on the attorney doing it and the attorney does not, that somehow now you have some protections that we should recognize and you should be allowed to be able to file this late CLA.
Well, because the leave application is a matter of right. So the failure to provide appropriate legal advice and correct legal guidance to the defendant deprived him of his opportunity for his leave. There's certain further consequences which are not of concern to this court, but it certainly deprived him of the ability to exhaust his state remedies, which forecloses other relief.
Is your view that your client's situation falls under Seivel, or do you think we have to extend Seivel to cover your client?
I believe Seivel can be read as covering this circumstance, because in the express language of Seivel, in carving out the second exception, there is the issue of the attorney's failure. And here there is an undisputed failure on the counsel's part, on my part, to advise him adequately regarding his the importance of the leave application that he had as of right to this court. Okay. And having failed to do that, I believe it does come within the compass of the second exception.
Sure. Short question. Yes. Do you agree? As I understand it, the argument you're making is under the state constitution. And under Wainwright, you're going to lose under the federal constitution.
Yes, sir.
You think we should not follow it under the state constitution?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks, Cass.
May it please the court, I'm Andrew Cass. I represent the people in this matter. Appellate division correctly denied relief. One, there's no right to counsel in connection with this. What we have, as the court has recognized, is a statutory right. Now, we have a perfectly valid statutory remedy, 46030, which also...
What about Seivel?
We don't have to reach Seivel.
Could this be read as a Seivel situation?
The problem is we would be extending extraordinary relief where a defendant, if he had exercised any amount of due diligence, could easily have moved for 46030 relief. And by the way, just to clarify one thing in connection with the court's question to counsel, if a defendant were beyond the 30 days after notice of entry, 46030 in filing a discretionary leave application probably could be to either court, because leave can be sought from an appellate division through either court, the appellate division or court of appeals. But in any event, we have a perfectly valid remedy. It is a state statutory remedy, but it also comes within the Constitution. There is no constitutional defect when it comes to a discretionary leave application in saying that 46030 is the only avenue of review. We do not need to apply a constitutional remedy, which, as I understand, in Seivel, addresses a critical gap when a defendant had no opportunity with respect to an appeal that was as of right.
But what do we do when the defendant relies on the attorney? Right, the attorney is going to file my CLA.
In this
record, of course, the defendant could do it pro se, you're correct.
Well, but we've won 46030 is there for that purpose, because it's not just 13 months, but it's 13 months starting from when notice of entry is served. I believe in this case that would have afforded the defendant.
You'll say this case isn't it, but you still can have a case where a guy runs out of time through no fault of his own, where it's entirely his lawyer's fault.
That case is not before the court.
And then, what is your position on that? Does he have a remedy or not?
The remedy is 46030, because we're only dealing with a discretionary appeal.
If the 46030 deadline has been completely and irretrievably blown and the defendant is without fault, is it your position that he's out of luck?
Yes, Seivel should not be extended, because we believe that even under 46030, or even if the court were to look at a Seivel remedy, there's still a due diligence requirement. And sitting on an appeal for 2.5 years.
Well, that's not the point here, though, is that it's the motion that was made and the 440.
I'm sorry, there's no 440 in this case.
I'm sorry that I'm looking at. I'm looking at either
there
the wrong
facts. There was a quorum nobis made in the
That's
appellate
what I'm
division.
About. Yeah, and it says the defendant was specifically advised by his counsel that he wanted to seek leave, and counsel agreed to do so for free. And it wasn't until February 2012 that he learned that the lawyer had not done so, and counsel told him that there was still a remedy necessary and a necessary motion and application to be filed. So there's no lack of diligence with respect to this. And he's saying, I'm not suggesting that the Court of Appeals must grant leave. I'm just saying I should have the right to make the application.
But The problem is raises the same issues addressed previously, finality. At some point, if a defendant believes, let's say, assume a defendant does reasonably have reason to believe that his attorney is going to seek leave. One, it's only discretionary, so that the prejudice is very, it's nearly impossible to gauge if you fail to do so.
Why is it only discretionary? Why is it only discretionary? Counsel says it's part of the whole leave application.
Because all leave applications are discretionary. That's by definition. It's by permission only.
And what standard of review are we using to review the appellate division's denial of this? Is it abuse of discretion or something else?
No, I think it's a question of law that the court correctly, as a matter of law, the appellate division correctly said that Seiville did not afford relief.
But you think it would have been beyond their power to grant relief?
Yes, because there was no articulated Sixth Amendment right to counsel, and therefore what your remedy is a state statutory rule, 46030.
Okay, counsel. Thanks. Thank you all. Appreciate it.